Hello, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Talk of the Rock. I'm your host today, Dylan Simard, and joining me is my dear friend,
Jared Griffin. Good to be here.
So instead of the usual Talk of the Rock, today we're going to get into the Scandies Rose hearing so far. We have about 50 hours of coverage to distill into this 30-odd minute block, including testimony from naval architects and surviving crew. We'll get right into it, but first we'll give you a little bit of information about the tragedy itself. The FV Scandies Rose, based out of Dutch Harbor, launched out of Kodiak on the 30th of December 2019 into exceptionally foul weather. Its crew of seven included veteran skipper Gary Cobbin, his son David Cobbin, Seth Rousseau-Ganeau, Arthur Ganassius, Brock Rainey, John Lawler, and Dean Gribble. The boat sank on the night of the 31st in freezing spray conditions with seas that witnesses testify was around 30 feet. John Lawler and Dean Gribble are the only survivors, rescued after 4 hours in a life raft and severely hypothermic.
We're going to play some sound from the Scandies Rose testimony now, in particular some audio from John Lawler's testimony. Listener discretion is advised. He is talking about what he believes are his last minutes on Earth.
Dean comes in the room, hops up in his bunk, and he's laying there for a little bit. We're bullshitting. I'm just about to nod off. And we were never like listening a little bit at all. It was trim, good to go. But then all of a sudden I rolled into my bunk and just this sheer terror comes over me.
According to their testimony, the Scandies Rose listed suddenly onto the starboard side around 10 p.m., sending the crew up to the wheelhouse in a panic. According to them, at this point, someone pulled the ship out of gear, speeding the rolling over of the vessel. The roll increased sharply, sending crew sliding around the wheelhouse.
I don't know how to explain it to anybody. It's just that gut wrench that this is not good. Like, this is, there's no coming back from this. Like, we are sinking now.
Lawler and Gribble are struggling to get their survival suits on.
Still trying to get my zipper up. Couldn't get my zipper up. And the wind's just howling out there. There's ice all over the rails. And I just remember hearing Dino yell at me, Johnny, like loud. I mean, I don't want to yell at you guys, but I turn around and he goes, what are we doing? And I don't know what we're doing. We're going for a swim. That's all I could say. And I told him I couldn't get my zipper up. And he started freaking out, trying to help me. But I couldn't help anybody. There was not enough time to help anybody. Everyone had to help themselves.
And now in the water, they are at the mercy of one of the world's deadliest seas.
Sat up for a second, bashing back and forth, you hear steel. I remember I was so stupid, but I was like the movies swim away from the boat, and I was looking at the boat, paddling backwards as hard as I could. And then 1 second, it just, like a rocket, was down, gone. Nothing but silence, it's me, the ocean. And I say the ocean like nicely, it was very violent that night.
In the raft, hypothermia sets in. The two men are still convinced that they won't be going home until they hear something over the roar of the waves.
And I kept telling Dino, I think I see something. I think I see something. There's someone here. I swear there's someone here. Oh, sure, you sure? And then that light went from right about water level and just shot up. And that's when I knew there was a helicopter. And it came flying, and I was shining a flashlight at it the whole time, hoping that, you know, someone was going to see us, because we didn't have a light in our canopy, and they must have saw the light, because after they shot up, they were hovering over us, and that's the most beautiful sound I've ever heard in my life. The rotors on that chopper, just the water spray coming out.
So now the two men are in a Coast Guard helicopter, and they are rushed to Kodiak for treatment for hypothermia.
Now here is where we get into some of the testimony investigating stability reports. Fishermen know well, but for those who don't, a stability report is an assessment of how stable a boat is, and it also provides instructions for the ship's master. It includes information like how many crab pots a ship can safely carry, and in some cases, instructions for what to do in icing conditions. Unfortunately, there seem to be some severe problems with the way that this weight is calculated. We're going to play audio from Terry Haynes' most recent fisheries report. This audio has three naval architects discussing the limitations of their stability reports.
A two-week federal inquiry into the sinking of the fishing vessel Scandies Rose on New Year's Eve 2019 began in Seattle this week. On Wednesday morning, three marine architects, Paul Zankich, Bud Bronson, and Jonathan Parrott, were asked by Barton Barnum of the National Transportation Safety Board about how the effects of icing conditions are calculated in a vessel's stability report. First to answer is Bud Bronson, then Paul Zankich.
We've been talking a lot about accumulation of icing on these vessels. Could one of you just explain to us the amount of icing that the regulations account for on board these vessels that operate in this area?
Item 28550 AB, I guess it's B1, says 1.3 inches on horizontal, 0.65 inches on vertical.
How would you apply these numbers to a stack of pots, given this guidance from the regulations?
I would have a drawing of the vessel that showed where I was going to put pots, and I would calculate the surface area that's vertical and the horizontal, and apply those numbers on there, and using a weight moment calculation, see what that did to the center of gravity. And therein lies the challenge, is that this presumes that that shoebox of crab pots is a shoebox. It's not a shoebox. It does not have a horizontal and a vertical surface. It has a bunch of pots in there that are just screens. As the water comes over the top, it's not going to lay on the top layer of the top on a bunch of pots. It's going to slowly filter down through all of them. And there's the challenge that we have, is we don't have any good information on how that happens.
The Coast Guard should contract with a university, the Navy, or somebody to take a crab pot or a bunch of them and put them in a wind tunnel with wind and put them with spray and see what really happens to a pot. Although we can tell you what's going to happen. We've got photographs of pots that are nothing but ice. But to see how quickly it can accumulate in a, pick a number of 40 knot wind at 15 degrees out. And if we had some of this data, maybe the Coast Guard could revamp their IMO standards here, which are clearly not real life in the North Pacific.
The U.S. Navy has a publication on, talks about icing of vessels. And the challenge is that they're all solid surfaces.
One follow-on question, my last question here. To you, Mr. Bronson, you mentioned earlier you taught some stability classes. Could you elaborate on that some, please?
For 5 years, I taught a one-week course on ship stability, and we talked about icing. But the challenge even then was we didn't have any good information on how a crab pot ices, so we used the IMO criteria, which says use the outside of the crab pot. And a crab pot isn't really a box. It's this sieve that collects ice all through it.
Turn it over to counsel representing vessel owners, Matson Management Company.
So if I characterize it as you are three interested citizens with specialized knowledge who are volunteering your expertise to the industry, is that a fair assessment of what you're doing?
Well, let me make a statement here. If you're a crabber, you have to believe the Coast Guard standards. You have to believe the IMO standards. You have to believe your naval architect. All of these three beliefs need review in this inquiry, because we are the naval architects who are asking our owners and operators to believe. And we rely upon the Coast Guard standard to believe, and the IMO standard to believe. And honestly, I don't believe those standards now.
Mr. Bronson, care to comment on that?
I think he reasonably describes our problem. We understand how the IMO came up with the standards they have for icing, but the crab fishery in the Northwest Pacific is significantly different than anywhere else. I've done work everywhere from Northern Europe, China. I'm doing work now down in New Zealand. This fishery is different than all of the others in that we have this lovely device called a crab pot, which we all love because we love Alaska king crab and all like that. But it doesn't behave the way we're told we should apply the rules. And at least from my own point of view, I've had a master's license. I've sailed. I've been up there. I've done tuna fishing. I want those guys to come back. And with apologies to the ladies, I want those guys and gals to come back. I want the stuff that the work that I do, I want them to give them a chance to come back alive. And with the king crab pots right now, I don't want to restrict them if I don't have to, but I sure would like to make sure that the information I'm giving them is the best chance to come back alive.
When a stability study for a vessel like the Scandies Rose is done, according to the current regulations, does it assume that ice accumulates on the outside areas of the pots only?
That is correct.
Mr. Zankich, reality versus regulations, how do they match up?
Well, I, as a naval architect, don't believe the regulation.
Mr. Parrott?
I believe the regulations provide minimal guidance in the application of ice. I know that there are situations where the boats will be out and they will accumulate much more ice than regulations provide guidance for.
But since Mr. Bronson has pointed out there are no good studies on exactly how much additional ice accumulates, do you have good quantitative data to provide to your captains as they consider additional icing?
No, we do not.
Okay, so joining me in the studio today is Terry Haynes. How are you doing, Terry?
Oh, fine. How about yourself?
I'm quite well. So you recently did the fisheries report in which you included all that testimony from the Scandies Rose hearing with those three naval architects. But I guess we should introduce your background first. You're a longtime fisherman, correct?
Yes, I had the opportunity to fish in the Bering Sea for crab for a number of seasons. I'm not sure what that number would be. It's in double digits somewhere.
Right. So throughout all these crab seasons, you've definitely had more than your fair share of encounters with icing on the deck of a fishing boat, right?
Yeah, some seasons, if you fish season after season, some seasons were, you know, had a lot of ice, you know, or you'd have to contend with it. It depends on the weather of the season and then what you're doing. Sometimes you go up for Opelio fishing, you'll fish quite close to the ice pack that comes down from the north because there will be good fishing there. And if it starts to come down kind of rapidly, you end up moving your gear and sometimes you ice up on the way back and forth.
So what's typically the response to icing conditions? How do you deal with them?
Well, it's only really one thing to do, and that's to go outside with some hammers or other implements of destruction and shovels and make the ice go away.
So you smash it to pieces, throw it overboard?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So what do you do? Imagine that you have like an incredibly severe weather condition, you know, 30, 40 knot winds, high seas of around 25 feet and heavy icing. What's the solution then?
Well, it can be really difficult. And when the weather is really, really bad, it's hazardous for the crew to go out there and to clear the ice. And that's, of course, is your dilemma. The one thing you have to do is, if it's possible at all, you have to send them out early enough that they can start to clear it and get it cleared away before it overwhelms you and this gets to be too much. And most of the operations I've been on where we had to clear ice, it was a regular duty, you know, especially if we're running, you would be able to run for a while, and then everybody got to get up and go out and clear ice for a while, and then you could run for a while longer. But the problem is, if the weather conditions are very severe, you're endangering your crew to send them out there. And I think that's, you know, that can be a really tough thing to do. The only thing you really can do is to, you know, run in a direction that doesn't reduce your speed, run in a direction that doesn't splash as much, and so you don't make as much ice. But basically, you know, you're caught in the horns of that dilemma. You have to send the crew out there, and you have to do it early enough and under such conditions that they actually can go out there safely.
And that's something that John Lawler, one of the witnesses and survivors of the accident, they asked him, I think, almost similarly that similar question, and he had pretty much Terry's response that at some point it's too dangerous to send the crew out there.
Right, and for, you know, normal icing conditions, which, you know, normal icing conditions, you know, in the Bering Sea are not normal anywhere else in the world, and you don't use crab pots anywhere else in the world like that. So they're unusual, but normal icing conditions, you know, it's coming on, you know, at an irritating speed, but it's, you know, at a rate and you can go out there and deal with it so that you can keep your boat clear and keep your vessel safe. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, you know, the ice can form so quickly that, you know, under unusual conditions, and as they pointed out, Sutwick Island, that area is really well known to be a dangerous spot to transit. And, you know, if the conditions are such that the ice just comes on impossibly fast and the weather is so bad that you feel that, because you're essentially sending your crew out into a big, lumpy ice skating rink.
Yeah, I've seen pictures.
And expecting them to swing sledgehammers and wield shovels. So, you know, as the master of the vessel, you have a responsibility to not send them into overtly unsafe conditions. But on the other hand, you have to make decisions sometimes to send them into somewhat dangerous conditions just for everyone's safety. And it's never an easy decision.
So what did you make of, I mean, you put that fisheries report together. You heard in great detail the testimony from those naval architects. What did you ultimately come away thinking with their testimony that they don't have complete confidence in their equations when they do calculations for icing weight?
Well, you know, and I think when you heard the on-the-ground fishermen testify, they did give a sense that, you know, in the field, you know that you have to kind of make that calculation in your head. And that is sometimes has to do with how the boat feels, you know, how it looks, how it seems to you. I mean, you can look at what the stability report tells you, but it only tells you so much, and you know that it's, you know, conditions aren't such that the ice forms evenly everywhere and your pots are not a flat square surface, you know, they're made of web. So, you know, I think in practice in the field, you know, those fishermen are out there making the best decision they can by the seat of their pants. And that sounds like that was probably the best way for them to do that, because if they had gone strictly by what they would get from the stability report, they wouldn't have good information anyway.
So we haven't really gotten into this so much in the beginning part of this talk of the rock, but there were very severe issues with the stability report on the Scandies Rose, according to testimony at least. What was your read on some of those errors?
Well, I mean, I think that's every fisherman's fear. You know, you look at that stability report and you assume that it was done in a way that, you know, that you can take that and make decisions with that information. And, you know, I don't think that, I sure think it's too early to besmirch the entire industry of naval architects and people who do those kind of things, because I think on the whole they're, you know, amazing people who, you know, it's almost, you know, an art science, you know, can. But, you know, I think that it's going to end up getting a lot more scrutiny, I imagine. And for folks who are looking at their own stability reports, you have to question, you know, how accurate is this? And you know, for, you know, I mean, it calls into question whether people who put these stability reports together have in the back of their minds, you know, what the desire of the person you're making the report for. And maybe that there should be some sort of third-party scrutiny for them.
Dylan, you reported on the testimony of Andrew Lawrence, who is a naval architect and expert on ship stability. They asked him to do a stability report on the Scandies after the tragedy, and he found the stability report underestimated the surface area for the crab pots pretty significantly by 25%. Didn't define the bulwarks, the down flooding points. There's a lot of questions about the exhaust vents. So it seems like there were a lot of criticisms about this particular stability report. Yeah. Also added on, and then added on top of that, that there hasn't been a full-fledged comprehensive study,
right,
on stability and icing, especially with stacked mass of pots, right?
Yeah, and I think in the article to which you're referring, I used the exhaust vents as an example of a downflooding point, but there are many. I think we spoke at some point. You mentioned that you had worked on a boat where they had a exhaust point that was on the deck of the boat.
Well, no, that would be vents for fuel tanks.
Right.
So you could get, it's possible. But that's not the same as an air vent,
right.
Where water could go right into the engine room.
So what would be your read then on having major issues with, I think on the Scandies Row stability report, they also misplaced the location of some of the tanks on the vessel.
Right. Well, I mean, and I'm certainly not an expert. But from the reporting, it seemed like that stability report was just incomplete. It seemed like it was just maybe not to the highest standards. And probably, I would guess if you looked at other stability reports, you might see a lot higher standards, other places. But I imagine that the operators thought that this stability report was up to snuff and as good as any that they're going to get. And, I think, that's the problem.
Right.
If there needs to be some sort of standard for stability reports, rather than just between the client and the maker of the report.
And originally, Bruce Culver was the naval architect who did the stability report on the Scandies Rose in 2019, and that's the report we're referring to. And originally, he was not set to testify, but they've added him. He'll be testifying in a couple of days.
Thursday, I believe.
Thursday afternoon.
And they've set out quite a bit of time for him to
speak
to.
They have, yes, yeah.
So, yes, I believe that's Thursday afternoon. But with all these things said, we should also point out that this revelation, as far as the stability report's concerned, don't mean that these boats are, like, in chronic peril. I mean,
it's still rare. What happened to Scandies is still quite rare.
There is no, just because this one stability report seems incomplete and flawed, there's no reason to think that every other stability report out there isn't perfectly fine.
But it
does call into question the fact that this one could exist out there with what apparently are some pretty glaring flaws.
But with that said, though, the issue as far as, like, some of these stability reports will include sometimes instructions, like, if you are encountering icing conditions, maybe you want to have fewer pots on deck than you normally would, etc. And there were, I believe that's at the discretion of the naval architect, how detailed they make those reports. But with that said, there would be the issue that right now they don't really have a solid grasp of how much the weight is modified by icing on the crab pots, and there really isn't a standard for at what level naval architects will start giving out, warnings in their instructions to the master for what the ship can safely operate under. Do you think that there's going to be some sort of investigation about changing that around, or?
Well, I think they're going to look at getting some better information for the naval architects to work with. So that when they plug these numbers in, they can have reasonable outcomes that you can use on the grounds. Because I think that's one thing that we've learned is that they don't have any information that's really usable for the operators on the grounds right now. It's still a seat of the pants operation because their reports are based on the idea that it's a shoebox of pots that has smooth, flat surfaces all over. And as we've learned, that's just simply not the case. It's a box of net. And we don't know how the ice forms, but we do know that it probably forms a lot more inside the pot than is taken into account in the standards that they're using, that the Coast Guard supplies them with. So,
and so even if you had, you know, the perfect stability report, or with, you know, very rational recommendations and feedback, but some of the witnesses have testified that there might be regulations and standards, but there's still very little enforcement. Cecily Lowenstein, who is a naval architect and reviews stability reports for the Coast Guard, she says it's, I think this is a direct quote, she said it's the wild, wild west out there, because there's no enforcement of these things.
Well,
very little enforcement.
It would mean a commitment of some, you know, significant personnel in the field. Mm-hmm. And one thing that they were starting to talk about is weighing pots. Mm-hmm. That could be very useful to the operator. You know, sometimes you don't really know. You don't carry around a pot scale that you slide the pot on and check before the season. You know, you probably have an idea in your head what each pot weighs. But it might be very useful to go boat to boat and weigh three pots, you know, that they're going to put on, and say, okay, here's what you have to work with. Here are your numbers as far as we can see them. You know, one thing that you can say about the Coast Guard and the stuff that they've done since the Americas and the Altair have gone down, and since, you know, other marine tragedies, is they've been very accessible. You know, they've really worked with industry to, you know, help them be compliant to, you know, the safety standards that they come up with. And, you know, I would think that they would continue to do so with this crab, with the crab industry, and hopefully come up with some, you know, more useful figures about what kind of weight they can add to their load with, you know, different levels of icing.
So we're getting into our last 2 minutes here, and there has been a little bit of discussion. They've asked some captains about this and some of the crew. Can you explain what tarping is and what the benefits are, and if you've ever seen it in action yourself?
Yes, my experience with tarping is it's a pain. It's it's an extra job, and so you're not, you know, too enthusiastic about it. But every time I've seen them in use, they work fine. Well, basically, you just put a tarp, and don't think of a blue tarp that you'd buy at True Value Hardware. Those are used sometimes. But they don't last very long.
I wouldn't imagine.
It's probably better than nothing. But we're talking about a heavy canvas tarp. And when on the Kodiak and the Determined, they had tarps specifically made for their stack. So they would fit over the stack. And the things weighed a lot. We had to put them on with a crane. Then we unfolded them, and they perfectly covered the tarp with a very, very heavy-duty canvas covering. And the ice just doesn't stick to that surface like it does to pots. And that surface, ironically, is much closer to that one that they use for their calculations. It's a smooth, flat surface. But it's also one that's flexible, and so it's easier to knock the ice off, and wind and that kind of thing tends to flutter it a bit. That tends to knock the ice off, too. So it can be very effective. You know, I think tarping could be something that could be put into greater use. But again, it's a decision that you make operationally. It does take a little more time. The cost isn't insignificant. That's a big, expensive tarp.
Sure.
And simply putting the tarp on and off has a certain element of danger to it itself, you know, at sea. So,
and then in that case, so all you're really worrying about is smashing ice off of the bow and then the bulwarks, right? And the scuppers.
Right, and you have to keep your scuppers clear. You know, that's very important. I think that's one thing that one of the skippers pointed out, is that we don't know anything about free surface water that may have been trapped on deck once the scuppers froze over. But that is something that operationally you have to do all the time on the grounds, is to keep your deck clear of ice and keep your scuppers clear.
Okay, well, thank you so much. This has been another episode of Talk of the Rock. Joining me today were Terry Haynes and Jared Griffin. And thank you both for your help in covering this story.
Thank you. It's been great.
See you, Dylan.